Sandra Gallegos, the preservation administrator of George Blood Audio and Video. She holds a Master of Science in Information Studies from the University of Texas School of Information, as well as a Certificate of Advanced Study in Preservation Administration. Before coming to work for George Blood, Cassandra held a position in the Digitization Department at the Harry Ransom Humanities Research Center in Austin, Texas. She has written several preservation assessments for various libraries and museums, most recently including the Smithsonian Institution, Anacostia Community Museum. Cassandra speaks today about listening closely to survey data in her presentation, and the survey says, okay, but the data says.
Thank you, Bill.
A warm welcome for Cassandra.
I am indeed going to be talking to you today about data, but hopefully in a new direction. Every year, at every conference, there are multiple presentations on preservation surveys. Well, this information is presented pretty straightforward, exactly as it came from the survey, but I got to thinking, there has to be another way to listen to our data and hear what it has to say, because if we don't, our survey data can become nothing more than just noise. There's something about data that captures the hearts and minds of librarians. This love affair causes librarians to rely heavily on data collected from surveys, with hopes that this data will guide them towards making a definitive decision on any number of preservation concerns. What should I digitize first? How much of my collection has problems with mold? Is this object going to deteriorate soon? Unfortunately, data alone can't tell you what to do, and it's unlikely to tell you what you don't already know about your collection materials. Survey zeal hits fever pitch when it comes to audio and moving image materials. The idea that more data equals a better protected collection is prevalent even amongst those of us who should know better. But surveys and data are not the enemy. In fact, they can be quite helpful if we know what questions we want to ask of our data. For my research, I worked with Columbia and Harvard University data. AVDB is a popular survey instrument created under a Mellon grant by Columbia University for audio and moving image collections. Applicable either to an item-by-item inventory or a random sample survey, AVDB does not require collection of a great deal of detail about each item, but has the ability to be a very granular tool. Technical terminology is based on that used by the Audio Engineering Society, Association of Moving Image Archivists, and other relevant organizations. Harvard University created a similar tool called SAVE, which stands for Support for Audiovisual Evaluation. Both the Columbia and Harvard University survey tools have collected rather large quantities of data. Now, the law of large numbers tells us that large amounts of collected data have a similar distribution pattern, a bell curve. In other words, the more data you have, the more likely it will assume the standard Gaussian distribution. George Blood Audio and Video is in a unique position to harvest the metadata we collect from a large number and variety of both institutional and private collections. The difference between the data collected with AVDB and the data collected at our facility, as well as at SAVE, is that there is no guesswork used to harvest our data. It is hard data, rather than survey data, which often includes a lot of guesswork. We have collected a vast number of metadata fields on 33,000 objects and counting. These factors, large number of institutions, wide range of collections, large number of data points about actual samples, allow me to consider our data set as representative of the general population. Oops. I've used this general population, the George Blood audio and video production data, to spot trends, then make hypotheses based on these trends, and test these hypotheses by examining the similar data points from the Columbia and Harvard surveys. In what ways do the surveys gather information which is similar to or different from the actual data in the George Blood audio video production data? Furthermore, I wondered, is it possible to extrapolate for unknown or uncertain data in surveys based on known information from our production data to help librarians and archivists make educated guesses about their collection materials? Now, I recently discovered that this presentation was accepted to the 2011 EASA conference. So my aim for this presentation is to gain any insight that this group may have, as well as ascertain whether or not you all feel this is an avenue of research worth pursuing. In analyzing my data, I needed to control for a few factors. Some institutions collect their data on a different basis than ours. Is the intellectual unit or the database record single object or a single interview, for instance? Another challenge was that new records are being added to our production data all the time. For this reason, I used 1%, or approximately 300 objects, about 1 week of our production as the margin of error in my analysis. The first data I collected concerned format and length of audio. At George Blood Audio Video, we assessed 32,699 audio objects to date. Out of this total, 15,390 are reels, and 13,399 are cassettes of various types, including microcassettes and DATs. This accounts for over 90% of the audio we handle. After these two formats, numbers take a drastic downturn. 5% are mini discs, 5% are discs. Cylinders, wires, and CDs each account for less than 1% each. Similarly, Columbia surveyed collections are 85% magnetic tape, either reels or cassette-based, with approximately 35% being reels and 50% being cassettes out of 35,766 total audio objects. Harvard Audio surveys, their survey of 3,839 objects is 68% cassettes and 22% open reel. As far as reels are concerned, I know anecdotally from handling lots of materials that many more of the reels we see suffer from poor tape pack rather than biological contamination or chemical degradation. I tested my experience against the data collected at Columbia. They assessed that 90.59% had a poor library wind. This information is critical for an archive thinking about creating an in-house audio digitization department. It may make sense to have a large-scale library wind project. After spotting these specific trends in collection content, I brainstormed what questions could I ask of my data. Librarians and archivists in general are concerned with issues of degradation, such as sticky shed syndrome and contaminants such as mold. As preservation administrator at George Blood Audio and Video, I constantly get questions on baking tapes from archivists. How to do it, when to do it, and if it even should be done at all. I wouldn't be surprised if there are portions of collection out there that are cooked to an oblivion by a well-meaning archivist. I wanted to know from our production data how often sticky tape occurred. Surprisingly, I cannot tell you. At our shop, it has been our experience that most tapes that come in exhibiting signs of sticky shed syndrome will get better after spending 6 to 8 weeks in our temperature and humidity-controlled environment. The tapes that are still sticky after their stay in our vault are tapes that will require baking. While I cannot tell you how often sticky shed syndrome occurs within the general population, I can tell you, within the general population, how often tapes will still need baking, even after stored in proper, low humidity environments. Around 6% of all the tapes we received required baking, and this is highly concentrated within collections. If kept in the correct conditions for longer, who's to say this may not cure more of the sticky tapes? The data here tells us that it's not a large problem within a collection. Proper storage conditions should be the primary goal, because A, there is likely only a small chance of encountering a very bad case of sticky shed syndrome, and B, since this chance is indeed so small, it is more cost-effective and safer to send out these few reels to a professional rather than risk these materials by baking yourself. As for mold, less than 1% of reels had mold. Mold occurs only rarely on other media. Jim Riley at the Image Permanence Institute speculates this is due to the nature of the exposure of the media. Magnetic media does not contain anything that the mold will live on. It's growing on the biofilm that develops on objects when exposed to the environment and human handling. Now, since reels are more exposed, more biofilm develops and therefore supports the growth of mold. So while mold and sticky shed syndrome should be taken seriously, they do not occur very often in the general population. Worry and effort should be placed elsewhere. Be aware of these issues, but only so much as to know when to seek information and help when these problems arise. I asked further questions of my data concerning reels. I wanted to know how many of each stock brand required baking. Is there a correlation here? First off, the two tape stocks we encountered most often were Scotch and Ampex, with Scotch coming out as the clear leader. However, we only ended up baking about 2% of the Scotch, while we baked 19% of the Ampex. Among compact audio cassettes, I found that both Columbia and George Blood audio video cassettes were approximately 92% type 1, which is not overwhelmingly surprising, as this was the most affordable type of cassette. What was surprising is that 50% of the cassettes we received needed their record tabs popped. Popping record tabs is the cheapest and easiest precaution you can take towards safeguarding a cassette collection, yet half of all cassettes were left without write protection. In some cases, whole collections were in danger, while others only had one or two cassettes with unpopped tabs. Additionally, we understand that replacing the shell solves most cassette problems. We replace cassette shells on about 3% of cassettes. Surveys like AVDB and SAVE and others can only collect known data. Object duration is one important datum that is often not known. Our data collection is a survey of sorts of actual known data. I discovered the following data concerning average durations for objects. Audio cassettes were at 53 minutes on average, reels 50 minutes, mini discs 60 minutes, discs 6, microcassettes 30, and DATs at 69 minutes. Many surveys allow you to collect maximum duration based on the possible duration of the audio object. For instance, you assume a C90 cassette is full of 90 minutes worth of audio. The way Columbia collected their data doesn't allow me to pull the data out of their survey. Our production data, however, does include information about the actual distribution of durations within each media category. Track configuration on a reel is also not often known until time of transfer. Unless the archivist owns a magnetic viewer and has an inordinate amount of time on their hands to discover the track configuration of all of the reels within their collection. We found that a reel will be full track around 18% of the time and quarter track about 5% of the time. The remaining 77.4% I found were half track. The distribution of speeds among reels varied greatly. Most reels, 45%, are 7.5 IPS. 1.6% of the reels are 15:16. 14.5% are 1 7/8. 20% are 3 3/4. 16% are 15 IPS, and 1.8% are 30 inches per second. Cassettes did not vary as much as far as speed is concerned. An overwhelming 99% are 1 7/8 IPS, and less than 1% of all cassettes fell into either 15/16 or 3 3/4, which, needless to say, does not render well graphically. What I'd really like to know from you all is my comments, questions on my current data, additional data points you want like me to consider, also any questions you might have that could possibly be answered by the data collected, or we could start collecting data at this point.
Is this PowerPoint available? Because this is really useful information, especially for our digitizing lab, and maybe even some of the collection, the survey tools. Mm-hmm. Like, would they be available somewhere to look at?
Yes, I'm planning on putting it on our website. It's georgebloodaudio.com. George, just georgebloodaudio.com. I'll put it up with all the notes and everything.
Hi, Cassandra?
Yes.
This is really great to see. And essentially, my questions or comments are just give me more. But a couple things that I thought would be really interesting to know from your data. One would be about sticky shed. If it's possible to track back the tapes that you are baking against the storage locations they came from. Both Harvard and Columbia have high-density storage facilities that are close to your relative humidity metrics. And if we're tracking back that the tapes you're baking are or are not from those storage facilities, it'll tell us a little bit more about the effectiveness of environments. The other one was just all the data you collected about track patterns, inches per second, and all that stuff. It'd be really nice to see that against the projects they came from. That is, within a single project or a single recorded body of sound, how much variation is there in those kind of metrics?
I'd be curious to know about Dolby in cassettes in particular.
Jake, did y'all do a survey of audiovisual materials at USLA?
At UCLA, we've been doing sampling surveys of the collections.
So at UCLA, we've been doing sampling surveys of the collections, and within that, finding audio materials. But we haven't done the sort of Columbia, Harvard, Illinois AV specific survey.
So Illinois, I was just thinking recently, like it would be nice to get a third institution.
Actually, I would, if you want to do that, talk to Indiana University. They've got the treasure trove of data right now. And they have a wonderful storage area for that as well. Hang on a second, I got a question back here. Go ahead.
I'm from Dolby. And I'm curious to, since there are thousands and thousands of tapes in libraries using the Dolby system to make them, and the Dolby hardware is eventually just going to die and go away. That's what everybody's using now to decode the tapes is hardware. I'm wondering if you have in your data sets any data on how many, not only cassettes, but all other types of tapes have been encoded with Dolby. Is that part of your data?
The way that data is harvested in the database now, we can tell you whether it has noise reduction very easily, but the type of noise reduction is in a text field. But we can change that. If people think that's very important, we could break out A, B, C, real cassettes, SR, PBX, 1, 2, and begin harvesting that data. And we could just, you know, draw a line and say, you know, give us records after.
I'm wondering if it might also be useful to distinguish between certain types of collections, like oral history versus broadcast collections.
I was thinking about that earlier. We do collect mostly oral histories. We just haven't collected that information in the past.
And in addition, I would also, I think it would be useful to know, in terms of discs, percentages between aluminum-based and glass-based and paper-based.
And we just recently added, I guess within the last couple of months, a checkbox area for the engineers to tell us, so.
Is that something that you feel would be very important, in which case we can post-process the data for that? But it would be a lot of work. We just want to be sure that that's something people feel is important.
Yeah, Mark? My opinion is it would be important because the research archives that have field recordings as opposed to broadcast collections that have very homogenous tape collections, I think it would be interesting to segregate the data that way so that we could have a better grip. But because the broadcast archives are going to skew the data towards consistent length, long length, consistent track patterns,
for what it's worth, I would say anecdotally, without looking at the data, that broadcast collections don't represent a very large percentage of this data, but they're very obviously present.
Just a quick request for the gentleman from Dolby. And if you have any pals at DBX, we could sure use a plugin, a set of decoding plugins, SRWA. And obviously the different kinds for DBX, because we get materials all the time. And if we could just have a plugin decoding plugin, you could make it cross-platform. I think you'd sell a lot of them, and I bet everybody here would probably love to have one of those for their digital audio workstation.
How much would they pay?
Probably a little less than what you want.
Okay.
This is related to again the small guy versus the big guy. I get a lot of private tapes come in, and I think that my numbers, anecdotally, are probably far greater in terms of 3 3/4 and particularly quarter track, both recorded in all four on all four tracks individually as well as in stereo pairs, even if they're mono. But that number looks way low to what my personal experience is.
Cassandra, thank you so much.
Thank you.